It's so nice to see some new faces around. Let me give you kind of a little tour of the most important things you need to know. If you need the men's or ladies' room, you just go out here to the glass doors and then and take a left. We'll start at 5. We'll be over around 6. If you want to continue to stay and schmooze, you're most welcome to do so. Next month we will have a program on what independent directors of family-dominated businesses need to know in order to survive. That's assuming they do. And the purpose of seat at the table is for smart, savvy, bored people to be able to have conversations with each other. We do have that the Susan in this case, but anybody who is here, is the moderator, not necessarily the lecturer, but the moderator. So if you come, be prepared to talk. However, I also want to let you know that we record what we do, and then we place it on our boardoptions.com website and distribute it to my 3,000 best friends. So if you're going to say anything, just be aware that we are recording. What we do first is we go around the table where people can introduce each other, so that after the program, if there's somebody you want to talk with, that you can do so. So why don't we start with Paul?
Hi, I'm Paul Cussell, formerly low-tech men's apparel manufacturer. I'm on a number of boards, and apropos today, been involved as an acquisition and made a number myself, as well as divestitures. So I'm looking forward.
John McCann, I'm a retired CEO of mostly industrial manufacturing companies, both private and public, and I'm focused on a couple of board seats now. I've been on 5 or 6 boards in the past.
I'm Steve DePalma, I'm the Chief Financial Officer of a biotech company. Been in life sciences for about 30 years. I sit on one board now, sat on a couple of boards in the past.
I'm Bill Hewens, and I'm Vice President International of Welch's. Grape juice company, not so high tech as my colleague here. I am serving Welch's not only as international vice president, but chairman of our board of our Chinese subsidiary, which has been a very exciting opportunity. And I hope to expand some of my experiences and other board experiences. So that's one of my goals.
Hi, I'm Ellen Richstone. My background, CFO of companies in ranging from $100 billion to $2.5 billion in revenue, mostly public companies, mostly technology-based. For the last X number of years, I've been sitting on boards, like these gentlemen. I'm currently sitting on 2 boards and about to join probably 1 or 2 others at this point. And over my career, I've closed and integrated almost 40 deals.
Can we switch seats?
Great. Ed Ross, background is in life science, commercialization, sales, marketing, consultant now, and also an active angel investor, and lead a small group of angels, and sit on a board, a couple of boards, and advisor to several startups, not necessarily in the life sciences space.
My name is Chris Sekulan. I work with a number of private investment firms focusing on investing in low-tech businesses that have revenues between 5 and 50 million and EBIT between 1 and 5 million.
My name is Tom Kennedy. I'm an executive communications coach in presentation, public speaking, media skills, and I sit on 2 boards.
Abigail Sewell, and I was invited here as someone's guest. Actually, and since I don't sit on any boards, I said, do I really have a seat at the table here?
Yes.
I'm actually in transition, looking for either a director of VP level sales role in a software company, and I hope to be on a board at some point, so I feel like I have a good role for
it. Larry Smith, I'm co-founder of Equity Metrics. So we're launching a technology products called Decision Intelligence. One of them being acquisition risk intelligence and an emerging space around decision intelligence.
I'm Barry Costlow, I'm managing director of an executive benefits firm, and I sit on a couple of not-for-profit boards.
I'm Pete Militic, I'm a founder of Team Metrics,
Corporation, which specializes in advanced performance metrics in corporations.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Corbett. I'm the CFO with real estate construction experience over the last 3 years. I started a little in transition myself from my last company last month. I sit on one private advisory board, and I sit on the board of trustees for Wentworth Institute of Technology.
Hello, everybody. I'm Florence Bergeron. I'm a higher education manager, worked in higher education for a couple of decades, dealing with student records, confidentiality issues, meeting state, local, and federal requirements. But I want to know why higher education costs so much. Perhaps it's the legislation requirements we put on. And I'm looking forward to hearing what everybody has to say today.
Jay.
I'm Jay Galasso with GIR Enterprise Management. We work with private companies that are in some level of distress or facing some kind of challenges. Work with them by bringing in management expertise and get them through those challenges and get back on track. Through my career, I've done a number of acquisitions where I was on the buy side, been through it, having been on the bought side, and been involved in integration from an operational standpoint. Very interested to hear more from Susan today.
Nancy Martin, I'm also here as a guest. My background is in accounting. I've been on both sides of the table of acquisitions, both sides of the table of bankruptcies, specialize in change management, ownership changes, policies and procedures, drafting, and documentation. And I also am in transition.
I'm Bruce Shackleton. I'm an executive and personal coach. I work closely with family businesses and have sat on the advisory board of a couple of those businesses.
Hi, I'm Bill Mergen. I work at JP Morgan, where I'm an expense analyst. I work with a single client who has a market value of $150 billion, and I do client oriented expense analysis for this group of mutual funds.
Mindy.
Hi, I'm sorry I'm late. I'm Mindy Kornfeld. I'm a business attorney. I work independently with different companies. I've been involved with several deals and have seen good integrations and bad ones. And I've also worked to help companies get ready for sale. Right now I work with different companies, a lot in the technology space.
Having worked with Mindy, she's amazing.
So thank you.
Indeed, Mindy. If you need something, Mindy, please call her.
Absolutely. We've hired Mindy as well. And
absolutely. Well, let's give me the
let me just take a poll. How many people in this room have been, or at any point in their career, on boards of directors of public or private companies? Just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. All right, of the 10, how many of your 10 have been involved with acquisitions of other companies? 1, 2, 3. Okay. Of the three that are raising hands, how many of your boards put together a committee to sort of study the acquisition before the deal was being done to see if this made sense? So, 2. And of the 2, you see where this is going.
Yeah.
Of the 2, how many put together a committee to sort of say, okay, this is what the CEO promised when he did the acquisition. What happened?
I've been through too many on an operating
side. Ladies and gentlemen, I rest my case. The point that this is the second of two programs we've had on this topic about post-acquisition integration. And it sort of stems from a luncheon that I had with somebody from Skadden Arps, which is a well-known law firm that deals with M&As. And I said, how many deals have you done? And he said, hundreds of deals, hundreds.
Yeah, right.
And what happens after the deals are done?
Right.
I have no idea. And not only that, I don't care.
Yeah.
Which I thought, at least he's honest. And it's fascinating when I look at boards, they sweat over doing the deal, but once the deal is done, and except Ellen.
Well, the one thing I was going to say is the one other question I would ask is, before the deal is completed, how many companies have an integration plan laid out? Because that was something that we added into every one of the deals, is that the deal could not close if we, as the acquirer, didn't have an actual integration plan. Now, it always changed, but you actually had it laid out.
Susan has a black belt in post-acquisition integration. Susan and I have known each other for more years than either of us will admit. But we first met each other when I was on the board of website Web 000. That was in the dot-com days. And so I associated Susan with sort of early stage startup technology companies. But actually Susan has worked for some of America's most prestigious companies in different kinds of industries. Susan can talk about that. Her background is fascinating from a couple of perspectives. One is that she started in IT, so she brings a strong IT perspective, and then she moved into HR. She has an experience with fashion, with Mast Industries, which we know as the Gap.
Limited.
Limited. Then she was at State Street. And then you were at
Send.com.
And most recently at a company called Sircor, which a lot of people have not heard of, but they're into specialty pumps used in the process industries, oil, gas, chemicals, and the very acquisitive kind of strategy. And Susan has been on the forefront of that. So she's going to be talking about her experiences in post-acquisition integration of talent, not only from different industry perspectives. So. Susan.
Thank you, Larry. When Larry asked me to facilitate this discussion on the integration of talent or post-integration of talent, he asked me to focus on the subject from the perspective of the board of directors versus the management perspective. So that's the focus I'm going to put on this discussion. It is a dialogue, it is a discussion, so please interject or intercede at any point. I do have a couple of points I'd like to just cover to put out there. Having led HR for both publicly traded as well as privately held organizations, very acquisitive companies, I found this topic really interesting. Primarily because my experience being on the HR side or the management side of the desk, my experience was very few boards were even involved with talent within their own organizations, let alone getting involved with the onboarding of talent from an acquired organization. I know that's a general statement. I've got some thoughts here on some companies who have kind of transitioned and done it well. But I didn't want this discussion to be based on the opinion of Susan McQuaig. So in putting this together, I did research and I talked to CEOs, I talked to board members, I talked to deal makers, the heads of business development, and I talked to HR professionals, as well as thought leaders in this subject. So I really had an interesting time in having these conversations. So I'm looking forward to sharing a little bit about my learnings with you, then we can have a dialogue and discussion about what maybe has been your experiences and whatnot. I know it's going to sound odd for all of us, but it was well over a dozen years ago when McKinsey first launched their article on the war for talent. It's still very much in vogue, if not even more so than it was in 1997 or whenever it was when it was first launched. So the subject still is on the forefront of organizations. If you read any articles that interview CEOs and the things that they think about, they think about growing their businesses and being concerned not about running out of capital or running out of ideas, they're running out of people who can lead their organization to those next levels. Since that article was first published, McKinsey has updated it, and even more so now than it was prior, organizations that have a real rigorous and consistent talent management system perform much better than other organizations. They have the data and the research to demonstrate it. So let me start off with what I learned that really hasn't changed much. Bless you. What hasn't changed much is the initial governance of a board with regards to the board's approved strategy. Management's responsible for implementing it. The board governs, and they also are responsible for approving strategic direction. So having said that, acquisitions are very strategic in their direction. So the board does have a critical role in participating in the due diligence in taking a look at the deal. They tend to focus, in my experience, on a lot of the compliance. They tend to focus on risk management. They tend to focus on what I call the sport of spreadsheeting, where they're looking at pro formas, they're looking at the valuation, they're looking at making sure it's a good deal for shareholders, and another number of other aspects. But what I've found in sitting on that side of the table and having and being engaged in these discussions, usually the business development or the CEO leaders pitching these deals, and there's a lot of lively conversation, but I always wondered it never seemed to be a topic or conversation about the board's responsibility in governing over the talent management system. It just seemed that it didn't come up. So when you look back at the original McKinsey article, at the time, the CEO of Johnson & Johnson went on record as saying, gee, you know, there was a time when we developed our own internal talent. We didn't have to go outside. And now, increasingly, they're continuing to have to go outside. So again, talent management, the criticality for business strategy is still very much alive and well. And yet, when I looked at companies like Johnson & Johnson, I just went online and I downloaded their charters, their governance charters, whether it's a comp committee, whether it's the nomination committee. And it's still amazing to me how the charters are still very silent with regards to the board's role. The closest in the majority on the comp committee will have some line that says they're responsible for the CEO succession. So there has been that focus on kind of that very senior level individual. But if you look at what has changed, you see companies like GE, which were on the forefront of really looking at this, and they were always, as we all know, very focused on talent development and grooming their general managers from within. But they were one of the first to take it to the next level and rename their compensation committee. So the GE's compensation committee is Management Development and Compensation Committee. So I thought, knowing what I know about GE and their discipline around talent management, I took a kind of peek behind the covers and I looked at who sat on their comp committee, who were comp committee members at GE. And one of the most prominent ones is Andrea Young, who's the CEO and chairman of the board at Avon. So I thought, well, this is interesting. She sits on the board of the Management Development and Compensation Committee of GE. So I went on and I pulled the comp committee charter for Avon, and it was totally silent on talent management, and it was very very generic, very general, very what you would normally see when you look at the traditional elements of a comp committee charter. So when I look at the board of directors' responsibility for their own ongoing education. As we know, with publicly traded companies, there's a lot of scrutiny over board members keeping their skills up in whatever discipline it is. So then I went and I did a search to look at these institutions that provide board members with this opportunity to continue their education. And again, this is not an exhaustive experiment or research on my part, but with every session or discussion or seminar, or I found it was about M&A, but it was totally focused on the deal. It was totally focused on scrutinizing the valuation. It did mention, you know, making sure that there is integration, but it tended to be more integration focused from the compliance perspective, whether it's financial reporting, whether it's risk management, environmental health and safety, if you've got manufacturing plants and facilities. So again, I thought, if it's so critical and so important, it just didn't seem to me to be getting the type of visibility in some companies, in many companies, that it probably should. Now, I'm not at all suggesting that these companies don't have some type of a talent management system at play, but I'm going to share with you a little bit later kind of the true confessions of an HR professional are the types of questions I would expect a board to ask a head of HR in this pre-close dialogue and transitions. One of the major competitors of CERCOR is Parker Hannifin. They are a world-class company. Many of you, I'm sure, know of them. Very acquisitive company, global. One of the first companies to really go deep and broad into China. And I know the VP of HR there. We sat together on a Manufacturers Alliance Council. And so I just thought, pull down the Parker Hannifin Comp Committee Charter. And their committee is called the Human Resource and Compensation Committee Charter. And the first line says, the purpose of the committee is to A, review the company's talent management process to ensure a continuing executive leadership pool. And to me, that's what it's all about. And again, we'll talk a little bit about integrating talent post, but I just wanted to set it up a little bit about the board's general role in overseeing and governing from the talent management perspective. So I'm just going to read with you one of the board articles that I found on the board's role in mergers and acquisitions. So here are the seven questions. It says the seven questions boards always ask. Number one, why are we doing this? All right, vetting the strategy. Number two, what's the best corporate structure? Okay, we get that one or two companies are combining. You got to look at the organizational structure, what makes sense, what business they're in. Number three, how will the authority of our board be affected? All right, who's going to sit on the board? Who's going to be on which committees? How will board members be chosen? All right, this whether it's two public traded companies or a private going into a publicly traded company, they're going to be interested in that. Who will be the CEO? That's another great question, depending on the structure of the deal and the competency of the two CEOs. Number six, what will happen to our most treasured facilities or programs? And number seven, is it legal? So again, it goes back to the compliance. So these also, and I kept reading through to find about what role does the board play in pre or post acquisition integration of talent. So here's my list, the Susan McQuaig list of the top 10 questions that I think boards should ask during the initial acquisition discussions. Number one, how does talent matter in the strategic intent of the acquisition? How does it matter? If it's a high-tech company, if it's a grocery store, if it's a research and development organization, because it's not always that talent is necessarily key or critical to the strategic intent. So it's a good question to first of all figure out how important is it. Second, when does it matter, the integration of talent? Does it matter day one? Does it matter a year from now? And if it is day one, there's a whole other series of questions that should be asked. Number three, how does it matter to customers, to employees, beyond the shareholders, which are very clearly important? And then to the point that was made earlier, who is responsible and who will develop the roadmap, the integration plan, including who is going to lead it, the critical milestones, the process, and the dates. To me, those are governance type questions. Number five, who will determine who has the best talent management system? It's not always the bigger or the acquirer that may have the best practice or the best systems, as you all know. If neither can demonstrate that one is best or one is better, and there is some situations I've seen where both neither one of them even have a talent management system, what are the plans to create one? And again, who's responsible? Number six, why would a talented person from the acquired company want to work here? Just a general question about why would onboarding this talent, why would they want to work for us? Number seven, how frequently will we, the board, receive updates on the status of the integration of talent? It comes back to the process of a subcommittee or someone of the board that can focus on more of the details more frequently and then do report outs to boards of directors. Number eight, when can we expect to see the acquired talent on the talent review or succession plans? When can we expect to see that there's going to be that not just onboarding of talent, but the due diligence around whether it's skill gap assessment or what their potential is, whatever type talent management system is being used. Number nine, what retention hooks do we plan to put in place beyond the sign-on bonus or a stay bonus for individuals who are identified as critical to the deal? Usually companies are very good at quickly identifying who the talent is, where they are in the organization, but with the initial comfort level of a sign-on bonus, a little cash in the pocket, and then maybe a stay type incentive for whether it's long-term equity, whatever, over a period of time. But it's important that they don't fall off the radar screen after that point in time, and that's where good talent management system can help. And the last question, number 10, how will we know and measure that the plans were effective over time? I have never been asked one of these questions. I have discipline within my organization around talent management. I have a passion for it. I believe within the organizations that I work with, it's important. It's good common practice. But I don't see where I should be not held accountable and responsible any differently than the CFO in answering questions about internal audit or the head of business development being asked about what's the health of the feeder pool for potential target customers or so I put that out there as a challenge for board members who are finding themselves in this situation. Don't let the HR leader, the CEO, or any other member of management that's sitting around that room off the hook too easily, because as we all know, if we've been in these situations, the deal can get really exciting. I mean, you're doing the financials, you're finding stuff, you're fixing stuff, you're getting to know other team members, the board's starting to get excited, they're starting to see the viability of the strategy, and it could be a new geographic location, so employees are getting excited about being traveling and opening up a new office somewhere, and this particular subject can easily kind of fall by the wayside. And it's sort of like once the deal is signed, you got people looking around the room saying, well, now what do we do? Not in all cases, and I know that I'm generalizing. So here's Susan's, I think the only question that the board should need to ask after a post-integration, talent integration update is, how are we performing to plan, and what are we doing to learn and continuously improve our processes? So basically, it's pay attention up front, comfort level from a governance perspective that there is a plan, that it's a thorough, a balanced, and a complete plan, and then follow up to get updates, whether it's a smaller subcommittee, whether it's I did notice on some of the comp committee charters that talent management sometimes falls on the governance and nomination committee charters. Most of the time it falls under the comp committee. So no matter where it is, because if you get that discipline in place, first of all, looking at your own talent of the board, the companies that you sit on the boards of, it's a natural segue into the discussions around how we integrate talent into the system. Again, whichever system turns out to be the best. So my kind of final general comments before I'd love to get your feedback is from a recommendation perspective, and it was mentioned here earlier, if if the talent is that critical to the strategic intent of the deal, if it's really critical, there should be a smaller subcommittee that's paying a little bit more attention to this area of where is the talent. What motivates them? How long have they been with their company? What you know, if we're a good company, have other things to offer, what can we offer in addition to financial recognition or rewards? And most importantly, to identify to board members, who are these people? Where are they? I think it can give the board great comfort in knowing that we didn't just acquire a solid business, but we acquired a team and talented people that can continue to run it and take it to the next level. I also think that there are very few boards that I've done searches on that have board members that have a strategic HR background in some fashion or another. My experience has been, and again, this is a generalization, a number of board members on companies that I've had a leadership role in HR tended to be retired CEOs. Tended to be at a generation where some of this talent management stuff wasn't in the forefront as they were growing up through their careers. I remember when I did the first talent review of one company, publicly held company, it started off at the comp committee level, and then the comp committee said, "This is really good stuff, Susan. We want you to do it at the board level." So at the next board meeting, I went through the process that we had in place, all the different elements of the talent management system. And so it was, I can still remember, board members literally were getting up and they were looking at the screen and saying, "Okay, well, why did you have this person here?" And it was really great dialogue and discussion. So I thought, all right, next time I'm sitting with the comp committee, I'm going to pass it out there to say, "Hey, just what I did here to present to you folks. You know, GE is kind of the model, and they've renamed their comp committee to really reflect their role in talent." I couldn't get it moved. The same comp committee charter was the same vanilla one about compliance and executive comp and all good stuff. But even when they saw the impact, and if you look at this particular company's annual reports, the whole focus was on talent. So I just didn't see the visibility at the level that it should. And again, I'm repeating myself, but keep the chief human resource officer responsible and accountable. Doesn't mean they necessarily own it themselves. It means they're responsible for making sure that the senior leadership team is owning it and that it's trickling down throughout their organizations. I think that we would all agree, board members would all agree, with what Larry Bossidy was very famous for saying. At the end of the day, we bet on people, not strategies. So I'm sharing with you kind of the view and opinion of Susan McQuaig, what I found in terms of looking at this subject matter from a board's perspective. So I'd love to have feedback, comments.
Just a question for you. What type of measurement systems have you seen that provides transparency to talent management in these companies?
When you say transparency, do you mean to the employees or?
No, to the quality of the talent.
There's a number of different approaches. The ones that I'm most familiar with and the ones that I put the most confidence in is they must be done over time. There must be a consistent view of how talent is being measured, whether it's performance and potential. And the criteria that is being used could give confidence that when we roll up this data, when we make, whether you're using the 9-box or whatever process that you're using, that there's a lot of rigor around it. It doesn't stop there, though. As that evolved, I expanded the group of leaders who participated in the discussions around the talent because it was a global company. We traveled a lot together, we worked a lot together, And we had a lot of experience. So someone may say, you know, Susan McQuaig is great. She's got great relationships, you know, so, and we think she's got really great potential. And some else will say, you know, she's really great. She's relationship-based. But, you know, I don't know if she's managing from the benefits administration perspective. You know, our costs are increasing, and maybe, you know, I'm not sure that she's, I wouldn't rate her as high as you did. And so after that discussion is put in place, and, you know, we kind of, it's an art, not a science. But over time, the discussion doesn't stop there. It's then, okay, once we put people, well, now what do you do? And that gets into the real meat of any type of talent management system. It's the development plans. It's the giving people on-the-job experiences. It's looking at stretching them, giving them international assignments. It's looking at what now are we doing with the assessment that we made, and prioritizing it. There needs to be, you know, you can't develop everybody all at the same time, so there's a priority process that you go for. But even more importantly, when you do it over time, you can track it. You can say, this is where this individual started out. These are the things that we did. And this is where they are now. And there's lots of different ways to develop people. Sometimes it's developing them for general management leadership roles. Sometimes it's developing them to be more proficient in their area of expertise. When I think of areas like that, I'll think of engineering or those high professionals that really have great knowledge in their centers of excellence. Did that answer your question?
That did. I led me to another question, but I'd rather wait for the answer.
Susan, I've been charged with my job to find and develop talent in other business cultures worldwide. And that's complex, but I can imagine if there's an acquisition of a two foreign companies coming together. How have you seen any best practices there in terms of that? Because the talent equation is very complex.
That's an excellent question. And CERCOR has a number of international locations, and I had an HR team located across the globe. They were all skilled HR professionals. I didn't necessarily inherit them. I needed to top grade in some areas to put someone in place who understood general practices around HR and understood not just the local language but the local cultures. And in the case where we were developing a new performance management system, I actually selected the HR manager from Italy to develop the performance management system for all of CERCOR. And I did that because we all agreed from an HR perspective, did a lot of due diligence on the best research-based tools for competency modeling, succession planning, performance management. I am a very strong fan of Lominger. They were bought by Korn Ferry. They generated out of the Center for Creative Leadership, where people like Norman Schwarzkopf are graduates of. A very well-established organization. They have their tools translated into a number of different languages, so it was very easy to get the leadership team from an HR perspective from all these different countries, and it was Italy, France, China, India, England, Germany, Brazil, I'm forgetting one. And so one of the things I would do during the due diligence acquisition process, if they had an HR professional, even if English wasn't their first language, I would get a translator and I would use it as an opportunity to kind of share with them or talk to them about the profession of HR and kind of how CERCOR views it and kind of the tools we use. And it was the most rewarding thing to look across the table at somebody who's looking at something that they'd never seen before. However, they understood the concept because they had an HR background to some, and then to see them use it, whether it was a competency model, say, wow, I could write a job description from this, or, ooh, I have to have a performance discussion with someone, and I can take this card, and it tells me what it looks like if you're really proficient in this competency, and then you flip it over, and it says what it looks like if you're not, and just general tools like that. So, you go.
You might want to Google Costini,
Cultural Dimensions. Are you familiar with Tom Stevens? IBM hired Gert Hostede, who was a Danish psychologist. And the question was as follows. We are the world's largest technology companies. All of our engineers have advanced degrees. All of our engineers speak English, and nobody's talking to each other. And we're all talking in English, and nobody's communicating. Why is that? And so Hostede studied the engineers at IBM. So we're looking at a very elite population around the world. And he developed something called the Hostede Cultural Dimensions. And it's a free web, it's free. You can just go Hostede, Hostede, culture.
Wait,
Hostede, Hostede, culture, dimensions. There are five dimensions. And we use them, like we have 250 consultants in 31 countries. Everyone speaks English, no one's communicating with each other. And I find the Hofstede cultural dimensions an enormous help in terms of communicating to my colleagues. For example, if I'm communicating to an American executive, Hofstede tells me, focus on what's in it for you. Because Americans are very need-oriented. But if I'm talking to somebody from Saudi Arabia, they're not. They're focused on their tribe, their family. If I want to really motivate someone from Saudi Arabia, I would say, and your family, and your company, and your minister is going to be very proud of you. Whereas an American would say, who cares? Now, what's in it for me? The other thing, another way in which the culture dimensions is fabulous is we are working with people in France. There's a certain look that people in France and Germany give. It's a look of though you just smelled some rotten eggs, you know, something with the nose. Have you ever seen it? You know, it's looking down, you know, it's something with the eye. It's like you are a pitiful example of what's called humanity, you know, and that's the worst thing. Americans deal extremely well with conflict if it's open. What they can't deal with is the haughty arrogance of I'm better than you. And the problem with Americans when they're dealing with French and Germans, because it's nonverbal, and Americans aren't very sensitive to verbalizing the nonverbal, they can't discuss it, so they act out later on. And all that's from Hostede, so it's very useful.
That's good. I mean, any of you who've worked in China, and many of you have, you can see just, I have a team in China and a team in Hong Kong, Chinese, you would think.
You would think.
Boy, they don't talk to each other. I got two talented people that just don't talk to each other, can't communicate, and are at each other's throats. And it's something to, you need them to get the job done, you know, and that's the challenge.
Following up on that, let me ask a question on communications. I would suggest a layer to each of your questions, and that is, are we and how are we communicating that each of those decisions to each key audience, to the senior executives, to customers, to employees,
yep.
So on?
Good point.
Do you find that happening?
It's so the critical answer. It depends. Yeah. It depends. Yeah. No. Yeah. It's certainly not at the level where it should be. It's pockets of organizations that I've worked for really get it, and they believe in it. So it becomes part of the fabric. For example, if all hands meetings, there could be a group VP GM of a particular division, and it's so important to him that he'll talk about it and communicate the development plans and the career development and all the different things that are going on around his commitment to talent management. And yet there are others who, it's still being a push process from the HR side. So it's, that's why I mean by it depends.
Good question for you. I find it actually fascinating what you've told us so far, because I've been part of a merger or an acquisition company that I worked for by a bigger company. Our company was a boutique consultancy, so professional services, and all the assets, when they leave the premise, are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They, you know, whether you're going to see them in the morning, it's risky. And so the acquisition happened. So since we were actually a UK-based boutique consultancy, and what's important for who? The culture was such that the benefits were extremely good. Like, we had benefits like nobody. Because it's all transitioned from Europe here. And when we were talking with our colleagues from much bigger, much more powerful consulting companies, they didn't have benefits like we did. So when acquisition happened, they switched the benefits to the American part of the consulting company to American benefits, and everybody hated it. And what happened within 2 or 3 years, most of your senior assets have left.
Right.
You know, so now they have the brand, but nobody can do what the brand used to be able to do. So it is a waste of money, actually, if you think, from the standpoint of the acquirer. and it was their fault. Nobody else's. I read one some long time ago from Lewis and Allen research that I don't remember the exact number, but it was upwards of 50% of mergers fail to bring the results that were initially anticipated.
Current statistics,
75%. 75. I didn't want to be that harsh, but I know that it was substantially higher than 50%. And so I'm just wondering, what is your opinion about that? Why is it? I mean, because we all do the due diligence. The numbers are all there. But from a numbers guy, I can make numbers tell you whatever I want.
Yeah.
Anybody can.
Well, I think we all would agree that the real value creation of an acquisition is the post-acquisition. You can have a lot of deal junkies that can cut a deal and negotiate a valuation and make it happen. But those companies that are really focused on integration and one of my role models was GE Capital in terms of the way they approached the whole integration process. There's a great Harvard Business Review article called "Making the Deal Real." But to your point, and I lived through this in terms of when I joined Cercor as the first corporate head of HR, I inherited 33 separate business units, and probably 27 of them were within the U.S. I started domestically, but one of the areas that I saw from a synergy perspective was they all had their own benefits, they all had their own retirement plans, they all had their own brokers, they all had their own, and it was all over the place. Their vacation schedules, I mean, you name any benefit and it was different everywhere. And again, it's the approach that you take from the values and the culture that the company has to be mindful of that change process. It's not unlike any managing change, and it took probably 2 years, but got teams of people together, did the side-by-sides of the benefits, did the financial analysis and reviews, and came up with a strategy that had a give and take. It wasn't a just the European benefits are going away, and in their case, your business unit benefits are going away, and the CERCOR benefits are being implemented. So it was an approach where we could sit in front of, and to your point, communicate the whole strategy and idea behind it to the general employee population so that they could understand, yes, things are changing, and it's kind of a give and take. Here's what's going to change that might be viewed as a takeaway, but here's another add. And if you strategically look at it from that perspective, while employees might not like it, as long as they understand it, they'll feel that they've been involved in some way and that it's not just being done onto them. And it's the same with when you look at integration teams and the way they approach their role in terms of being sensitive. You know, we talked about cultural sensitivity, being sensitive to, you know, there's that expression that integrations are like taking off a Band-Aid. You can do it slowly or you can do it really fast, but either way, it's going to be painful. And that's a good point.
Anyone else? We have 10 minutes. Any of your own
experience? Well, I just sort of want to make sure that I understand. You seem to be putting forward the position I'm drawing from a previous seat at the table, which was talking about boards not really being as involved in the integration of an acquisition long term. And what you're indicating here is that on the human resource side, the board has to take responsibility of that element. But for most companies now, it's more down at the executive management level on a quarterly basis. The board sort of comes in and checks the box.
Yeah.
Right? And I would, is the reason for that because they really, boards really want to have executive management to own that because that's where it's all happening? And so what's going to be changing in the way that American corporations or global corporations can change their approach to bring it up to the board level?
That's a very excellent point, and I think that's the distinction between a board's role as governance as opposed to a board's role of implementing or executing. So when I'm suggesting, and the questions that I ask, and what my expectation of a board would be, is the board should provide that governance oversight to make sure that what you just described is in place, that there's rigor and consistency around management's implementing the tool, executing it, using it, just in the same as the board should be comfortable that the internal audit function has a very disciplined risk management process that they go through every year to identify. And the, you know, they don't need to get into the mechanics or the minutiae. But I just felt, in particularly going through this and by my own experience, and I'm flattered, but there was a lot of trust me, Susan, that went on in terms of I was doing it, but I don't know that if a board member was pulled aside to say, well, what exactly is she doing, and is it consistent across all the business units, or... So I just think that was kind of the point that with talent being on the forefront as it is within an organization, let alone with post acquisitions, you know, the boards sign off on the, you know, annual reports and the presidents or CEOs' letters, and every single one I see talks all about, you know, most valuable assets that walk out the door every night, and commitment to talent, and on their websites, you look at the career sites, and it's, you know, we're developing our employees and things. I just think that there's kind of a missing step there that the boards need to apply that same rigor.
We've got time for one more question.
It seems to me that with changing environment because of first Sarbanes-Oxley years ago and now Dodd-Frank, and the almost having to stand up to the plate and say, how diversified is your board? And why is this man or woman on your board? What do they bring to your board? Mm-hmm. A lot of, that's a big opportunity to get this right. If you're doing an integration and acquisition and the board is ignorant by the lack of experience, they are at an extraordinary disadvantage. Maybe that's why 75% of them don't work, but I could make a list as long as this table of the mistakes I've made over the years integrating companies. But unless you have an extraordinarily detailed plan and it's reported to that board and they feel responsible,
yeah,
I can't imagine how it's going to be done right. If you're doing an international situation, then evaluating that talent really early, if you can do it before you make the acquisition, mm-hmm. it gives you such a leg up to do it correctly or walk away. Now,
yep.
To walk away, again, you need the board to be really strong because all the attorneys in the room, PwC and Arthur Andersen, your British, French, German, Indian attorneys, they're all going to get a wire when the deal's done and they will be paid.
Yep.
It's true they don't care tomorrow, but that's not their job. It's the board's job. And these things take on a life of their own. And everyone does get excited and exhausted. So I can't imagine in the future, if you don't have a diversified and a lot of depth and breadth to the board, that you won't be in trouble and maybe compliance trouble beyond that.
Yeah. Great point.
So one of the things that we used to do was, I was on the board of American Power Conversion, which was an S&P 500 company, and we used to do a lot of deals. And you know, we had the little group that did the vetting in advance, but then before the deal was done, and for good or bad, I'd done so many deals that the CEO would have the team put together their integration plans and then let me play devil's advocate on the details. I mean, these were detailed plans before it was then presented to the board. And it just sort of grew out of the fact that there was somebody on the board who had done a lot of deals, lived through them from an operating perspective,
mm-hmm.
Versus a deal is done and they go home. And it was very, you know, it was, I had great fun with it. It was a lot of work, but I had great fun with it. But it's something that you know, as a board, it seemed to help us. And when we were on the other side, we sort of at least had a map for where we were going and at least thought it through. It changes. Mm-hmm. But at least we sort of have given it enough thought and time at all levels, the people level, the technology level, the, you know, the
yep.
people was always a big piece of it. It wasn't just the numbers.
The thing, too, that I've observed over the last couple of years is the public has not been kind to board of director members. Between Glass Lewis and ISS and vote of, you know, non-renewal or re-election, and it's really tough. And I found the dynamics, personally working with the compensation committee, just the scrutiny and the fear factor of not being in compliance. And it, to my view, it really detracted from some of these other things we're talking about running the business, as opposed to focusing on what, you know, somebody's gonna say in a report about who doesn't know your business, about what your long-term incentive drivers are, whether stock options are performance-based or not, or so it's tough on board members today, it really is.
Are they? Do you see people losing board members voluntarily because of that fear?
Not in my experience.
So you want to say that again?
Well, I asked you, would have you seen any loss of talent on the boards because they don't want to be on boards because of all the exposure and liability that they might be?
Well, since I do board recruitment, I do see a number of candidates that we would like to, you know, bring on boards. They go to their attorneys.
Yeah.
And then their attorneys, you know, give them a laundry list of what your risks are.
Yeah.
And it frightens them.
Mm.
So the more experienced governance people who sort of can evaluate the risks and the benefits, don't get frightened, but for it can be quite intimidating for somebody who's never been on a public company board to go to an attorney and then get scared.
Check the D&O insurance. Yeah.
Yeah, I think particularly if that board member, potential board member, is currently a CEO or currently has a significant leadership position in another company.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying other retired board members aren't going to give it the same consideration, but if you're in that spotlight, it's hard to get out of it.
Why don't we stop at this point? There's more sandwiches, more things to drink. Please continue to stay and schmooze, and I hope to see you next month at our next Seat at the Table program. Thank you very much, Susan.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Suppose we spoke the same way, maybe.
Yeah. Very good. Very good.
Good meeting.